And the reason he does this isn't actually for any movie set, he just said that he simply wants to be the best at falling. I'm not too sure why this is his goal, but I can definitely agree that he has some of the most graceful tumbles out there. This guy.
Morning. The goal of life is to be perfect, right? To never say the wrong thing, to never make the wrong choice, to never do the wrong thing, never attempt something and fail. You know, we don't say it out loud, but nobody ever really spends any time thinking about it because it's such a lofty and impossible feat. But nobody has their life goal, you know, fail. Be a failure. That's what I want to do. Except for that kid in the video, right? That's a strange, he's a weirdo, a little bit different. But nobody has their life goal to be a failure. And the irony of it is if they succeed, are they a success or failure? How does that work? Can you succeed at being a failure? We all want to be successful. And really, we want to be successful at everything. We don't want to fail at anything. I think it's fair to say that if we had full ability, full control to choose, we would choose to be perfect all the time. Failing is frustrating. It's sometimes embarrassing. It's time-consuming. We don't like to get things wrong. We don't like to fail. It's just as true with trying a new recipe or filling out our taxes as it is being a holy person. You know, at least I would like it to be that way. I would like for that to be true as a pastor. You know, in my head, everyone desires to be holy. Everyone here, anyway. The biblical way to say it is, everyone wants to be holy. Well, in our text today, in James chapter 3, he starts out talking about the cost or the price of failure in the context of teaching, but he quickly takes it far beyond the scope of just being a teacher. So we're in James chapter 3, we're going to be starting at verse 1. Not many of you should become teachers, my fellow believers, because you know that we who teach will be judged more strictly. He's saying that taking on the role of being a teacher isn't without risk. There's a higher penalty attached for failure for teachers of the word. There's a lot at stake. And apparently, it's serious business. Now, I don't normally stop at just one verse, but this next part, verse 2, requires the necessary attitude to understand it properly, in my opinion. Let's see if I can pull this off. Verse 2. Anyone who's never at fault in what they say is perfect. They're able to keep their whole body in check. I might need to try that again, but do you pick up on the sarcasm in that? Like I really, when I read that, I think I'm pretty sure that James is using sarcasm here. Because we all know very well that nobody does that. As much as we would like to be able to claim it, nobody's actually perfect. I know that sometimes we get tired of hearing that in church. Yes, Aaron, we know we're all failures. You don't have to tell us every week, right? But per James's sarcasm, nobody keeps their whole body in check. In fact, it's hard enough keeping one little part, the tongue, in line all the time. The tongue's a feisty little thing, isn't it? And in verses 3 through 5, James launches into a couple of illustrations about how hard it is to control and how important it is to control the tongue. Verses 3 through 5. When we put bits into the mouths of horses to make them obey us, we can turn the whole animal. Or ships, as an example, although they are so large and are driven by strong winds, they are steered by a very small rudder wherever the pilot wants to go. Likewise, the tongue is a small part of the body, but it makes great boasts. James gives us the bit and the boat. You know, compared to the size of a horse, even a small one, a bit is insignificant in size. And we should marvel at how well it does its job at giving us control of a horse. I mean, a horse surrenders its will to its rider when it has a bit in its mouth. It's the same thing with a rudder. If you have a boat or a ship, the rudder, very small in comparison, but in spite of the size of the ship, the strength of the wind, the ship obeys the rudder. It goes where the rudder makes it go. Now, this next part, the last part of verse 5 all the way to verse 8, it reminds me of, there were some DirecTV commercials a while back that I thought were really creative. They kind of have free rent in my brain. I don't know if anybody else remembers these, but here's an example of one of these.
On hold, you get angry. When you get angry, you go blow off steam. When you go blow off steam, accidents happen. When accidents happen, you get an eye patch. When you get an eye patch, people think you're tough. When people think you're tough, people want to see how tough. And when people want to see how tough, you wake up in a roadside ditch. Don't wake up in a roadside ditch. Get rid of cable and upgrade to DirecTV. When you're...
I love those commercials. They're great. They had about six of them that they cycled through. And I think they're great. And I show that because... It's, you know, it starts out pretty simple, pretty civil, you know, but man, it picks up speed quickly and goes downhill in a hurry. He goes from being upset on his couch about his cable bill to unconscious on the side of the road in no time flat. Like, it just declined quickly. And I'm going to take a few liberties with how I read versus the rest of verse 5 through 8, because I think that it reads kind of the same way as that commercial plays out. Consider what a great forest is set on fire by a small spark. Now, the tongue is also a fire. It's a world of evil among the parts of the body. It corrupts the whole body. It sets the whole course of one's life on fire, and it is set on fire by hell. Does it read that way for you? But I mean, do you see what I mean, though? I mean, let me make my case for this, and then we'll finish it out here. We went from just a spark. You know, sparks are petite. They're almost cute. They're minuscule. Nearly harmless. Nothing to worry about. To, well, now it's a fire. And then it's a whole world of evil. And then your whole body's being corrupted, and your life is going down in flames. You're going to hell, mister. You're going to hell, lady. That's where you're going to end up if you play with sparks. Then he continues, all kinds of animals, birds, reptiles, and sea creatures are being tamed and have been tamed by mankind, but no human can tame the tongue. It's a restless evil, full of deadly poison. James goes to a dark place in chapter 3. And he takes us with him. He paints this pretty dire picture, doesn't he? Seems pretty hopeless. Jesus once said that we would be better off cutting off our hand or gouging out an eyeball if either one of those were to cause us to sin, leading us to end up in hell. From the sounds of chapter 3, it seems like maybe James is under the impression that we should just all cut our tongues out and be better off for it, right? put out those fires post haste before they get us into irredeemable trouble. Dangerous things, those tongues. We don't need to be told how dangerous the tongue is to know it, do we? Because no one is immune to being damaged by other people's words. We say cruel things to one another at times, don't we? We even invent new words for it because the words that we currently are using don't wound deeply enough after a while. And so we create new words, new ways to insult people. We spread gossip to ruin reputations and sow doubt. We tell outright lies about people and to people. We boast about our accomplishments to make other people feel small. And we belittle their accomplishments so we can feel better and bigger. If somebody's proud about something that they did, we point out the flaws. Malice, slander, lying, coarse joking, belittling, criticism, gossiping. Every one of us has the scars to prove that we know words can harm. We all have had hurtful words spoken to us on the playground or the workstation, the gym, the beach, or the backyard. But words don't only hurt, do they? They can help. They can heal. James doesn't mention it in this chapter, but the tongue can also be a formidable force for good, too. Consider these examples that I was thinking about. First, I think about Peter on the day of Pentecost. He saved 3,000 souls in one day using his speech. If he hadn't spoken the words that he did on that day, if he hadn't preached that sermon, who knows what would have happened to all those people? Some good was done that day by the tongue. I think about the book of Ruth. Early in the story, Naomi has lost everything that mattered to her. Everything important is gone. Her husband has died. Both of her sons have died. She's in a foreign land, living there as a foreigner, as a stranger, and there's a famine. It's hard for things to get any worse than that. And in the depths of her despair, she appeals to her two daughter-in-laws and she releases them. You know, go figure out life for yourselves. And she relegates herself to isolation, poverty, and loneliness. And one of the daughter-in-laws accepts her generous offer and she leaves. Goes to try to figure out life for herself, start a new life. But the other, Ruth, stays. And so Naomi doubles down. Look, your sister-in-law is going back to her people and her gods. Go back with her. But Ruth replied, and these are beautiful words of encouragement. Don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go. Where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, and your God, my God. And where you die, I will die. And there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever severely, if even death separates you and me. How healing were those words in that moment. The time of her greatest sorrow to receive such love from another, to be so encouraged. I'm certain that that is what allowed Naomi the strength to continue. We have the story of Joseph and his brothers, where you know they beat him and were going to kill him. They instead they sold him into slavery, and we know the whole story how he was in Potiphar's house and then arrested and was in jail. But then he rose to power in Pharaoh's house, and he's the most powerful person in all of Egypt. And there's a famine that's going on, and Joseph, with his divine knowledge from the Lord, has prepared Egypt, and they have all this surplus, so everybody is beholden to Egypt, and his brothers come begging for food. And they don't realize it's Joseph. They don't know it's him. And the story goes on. There's a lot of things that happen in the meantime, but once they finally realize that it's him, can you imagine how terrified they would be in that moment? Well, we screwed up. But this is the words that came from Joseph's mouth. Do not be distressed. Do not be angry with yourselves for selling me here, because it was to save lives that God sent me ahead of you. God sent me ahead of you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance. So it was not you who sent me here, but God. And he tells them, go back, bring the whole family. You're going to be able to live here in Goshen. Everything's going to be provided for you, and you will thrive. And this is a good thing that you are here and that I was here. Those are good words to hear. You've got Jesus and some of his last words with Peter. At the end of the book of John, in chapter 21, Jesus has this encounter with Peter. And in the course of the conversation, Jesus asks Peter three different times, if Peter loved Jesus. Do you love me? And Peter would say, yes. He asks again, do you love me? Peter says, yes. And he asks again, which annoyed Peter the third time. But again, he replies, yes, Lord, you know I love you. Why do you suppose Jesus had Peter tell him three times that he loved him? Because previously, in a moment of fear and weakness, Peter had denied Jesus three times. And I can only imagine how that haunted Peter. But here, Jesus restores him and he redeems him and he tells his friend, even though you screwed up, you're still my shepherd for my people. You're still my guy. Take care of my people. Healing words, hurtful words. The tongue is a fire without question, but it can heal, it can harm, it can build, it can destroy. So let's observe a lesson that we can gain from a thermometer and a thermostat. This here is a thermometer. I have it in my office on my wall. It is a tiny, stupid little thing. I bought it. That's actually the picture, the listing from Amazon. I bought it by accident because I didn't carefully read the description and I didn't pay attention to the size. It says, it has a picture, 1 1/4 inch by 2 inches. It shows almost, I just didn't scroll over. And I looked at the picture, I thought, okay, it's about the size of the one that my mom and dad had or my in-laws had. And I thought it was going to be about this size, which is what I wanted. So I keep it there as a reminder. Don't ever do that again. So it hangs on my wall next to a larger one. I'm not kidding, it's that big. What does a thermometer do? Yeah, it records the temperature. It tells us that's what we use it for, to record the temperature. So what about this right here? What is this? Thermostat. What does it do? Regulates it. It controls it, right? You change the settings, change your environment. The tongue combines both a thermostat and a thermometer in the same device. And here's how. The tongue acts as a thermometer in this way. It declares the temperature level so that one's conversation, the way that you speak, reveals the level of your spirituality. It exposes the condition of the heart. Swearing discloses a profane heart. Impure stories, if those come out of your mouth, they disclose a filthy heart. Murmuring discloses a thankless heart. And criticism discloses a jealous heart. The tongue is also a thermostat. You know, a thermometer registers temperature, but it doesn't regulate it. The thermostat governs the temperature. It decides how hot or cold it will get. The tongue not only measures the moral condition, but it's also a determining instrument for it. In verses 3 through 4 of James 3, the tongue's spoken of using the figures of a bit in a horse's mouth and the rudder on a ship. And we talked about how a bit determines the course of a horse, making him turn to the left or the right, or letting him run, or you know, jolting him to a stop. Rudder on a ship determines the ship's course. It turns it in any desired direction. And similarly, well, my tongue's fighting me there. Proper use of the tongue can guide a person safely through hazardous circumstances where we might get into trouble. It can lower the temperature of pride. You know, we can use words to celebrate the successes of other people instead of always tooting our own horn. It can lower the temperature of jealousy or spite or a temper. Proverbs 15:1 says, a gentle answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. The tongue can lower the temperature of these and other sins of the tongue and make one more like Jesus. It can do good. So in light of our political state that we're in, you know, this is an election year, I present to you this gag gift that somebody came up with. We chuckle, but isn't that horrible? Like, we laugh at it and we think it's silly and, you know, that's horrible. Can you imagine going to a friend's house or a coworker's house and they have toilet paper just like this, but it's your face? Like, and I'm not talking like it's a setup prank, they did it just because they knew you were coming over, but like they've actually been using it. Or you go to work and every one of the bathrooms at work has your face on all the toilet paper in every stall. Or you go to a school event for a basketball game or a concert or a graduation, and all of the bathrooms have your kid's face on the toilet paper. That'd be a lawsuit that'd get somebody a lot of money right there. Why wouldn't we like that? You know, it isn't really me. It's not really you, it's not your kid, it's just their likeness, their image. So why would it bother us so much for somebody to do that? Well, it's because we know that our image represents us. Whatever they do to our image, it's as if they're doing it to us. Like, there's practically no difference, right? That kind of thing could end a friendship. Probably should. And that's the point that James makes next, starting in verse 9. He says, with the tongue we praise our Lord and Father, And with it, we curse human beings who have been made in God's likeness. So out of the same mouth come praise and cursing. My brothers and sisters, this should not be. Can both fresh water and salt water flow from the same spring? My brothers and sisters, can a fig tree bear olives or a grapevine bear figs? Neither can a salt spring produce fresh water. James reminds us that every human being is made in the image of God. We are created in His likeness. And so just like with the toilet paper, when we disgrace another person, we are throwing disgrace at God. When we use our words to harm other people, God takes that personally. James teaches us that God is not okay with people tearing one another down and then coming here and singing sweet words of praise to God with the same mouth. There used to be a saying tossed around by adults whenever kids had a potty mouth. When I was little, that they used to say, "Do you kiss your mother with that mouth?" I always thought it was kind of a silly retort myself, but that's pretty much the question that James is asking here. He says, you cannot do both. You can't praise God with your mouth here and then blaspheme His image in other places and expect God to be okay with that. It should not be, he says. One of the more challenging things that Jesus said was from Matthew chapter 12, where he says, make a tree good, and its fruit will be good. Or make a tree bad, and its fruit will be bad. For a tree is recognized by its fruit. You brood of vipers, how can you who are evil say anything good? For the mouth speaks what you are full of. A good man brings good out of the good stored up in him, and an evil man brings evil things out of the evil stored up in him. But I tell you that everyone will have to give an account on the day of judgment for every empty word they have spoken. For by your words you will be acquitted, and by your words you will be condemned. He goes even further than James and says, we'll have to give an account to the Father for every careless word that we speak. God will hold us accountable for the words that we use. The tongue is a fire. It can be used for good, but man, can it be used for evil. We need to control it, or it will control us. A long time ago, we taught our kids in children's church. There was a song that we sang all the time. A lot of us, when we were little, we learned this song. Be careful, little eyes, what you see. Be careful, little eyes, what you see. For the Father up above is looking down with love. Be careful, little eyes, what you see. Be careful, little ears, what you hear. Be careful, little ears, what you hear. For the Father up above is looking down with love. Be careful, little ears, what you hear. Be careful, little mouths, what you say. Be careful, little mouths, what you say. For the Father up above is looking down with love. Be careful, little mouths, what you say. We would be wise, as followers of Christ, to heed the words of two psalms and let them take up residence in our heart as a bit and as a rudder for our tongues. Set a guard, O Lord, over my mouth. Keep watch over the door of my lips. Let the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, my strength and my redeemer. Be careful, little mouths, what you say. For the Father up above is looking down in love. So be careful, little mouths, what you say. Let's pray. Father in heaven, we appeal to you for your grace. For there are times when we are not careful with the things that we say. And sometimes even worse, we are very intentional about what we say. And that's not what you expect. That's not what you demand of a holy people. We are to live righteously, which means we need to monitor the things that we say. But we need help, Father, because it is so easy for it to get out of control. So we ask for your Spirit to guide and direct the filter and help us to make wise choices with the things that we say, that we only speak things that build one another up in love. Your Son asked us to not just bless those who bless us, but to bless those who curse us. And to pray for those who persecute us. And that's a hard thing that you ask. But we know that you've given us the ability to do that. We have everything we need to live a life of godliness and righteousness. And so we ask for your help. We ask for your forgiveness in the moments that we fail. And help us, Father, to use our tongue for good. We ask this in the name of your Son. Have a great week.